In 1949, Evelyn Berkby, a career woman recently turned homemaker, started writing a weekly column for the Shenandoah Evening Sentinel. That was 63 years ago, and she hasn't missed a week. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today I'll talk with Evelyn Berkby, who has just released her 11th book, Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living. We'll talk about her career as a columnist and her time spent on the air as one of KMA's radio homemakers.
We were the Dear Abby of that day. There weren't support groups. So I think this is one of the reasons the radio homemakers grew so close to their listeners. We also shared our lives.
Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1949, Evelyn Berkby was living on a farm in southwestern Iowa, outside of Sydney, when she began writing a weekly newspaper column called Up a Country Lane. She still writes that column and has been for 63 years without missing a week. She also became a radio homemaker on KMA Radio, part of the Kitchen Clatter program, and she has written 10 books. Her latest is Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best-Known Homemaker. It's a collection of her favorite columns from her long career. Hello, Evelyn.
Hello, Charity, and how sweet to have this opportunity.
Well, it's truly an honor to get to sit down and talk with you, Evelyn. And let's start way back at the beginning. Let's go back to 1949. You married your husband, Robert, in 1946, but before you got married, you were a college-educated career woman. What had you been doing?
Well, I had taught school for a while, and then I went into religious education because churches like to have people that have an education background for their education programs in their church, and ended up at the Chicago Temple, the First Methodist Church in Chicago. And I developed their youth program because it's in the downtown loop area of Chicago where there are many, many little colleges, you know, like beauty shop colleges and barber shop colleges, and also Central Y, which is a university. So there were many, many young people who came, and I loved it. And I finished my education at that time in the University of Chicago, studying psychology, because I thought that would help me.
So you were living the big city life.
And I loved the big city life. And why, you know, I still wonder why I came home, and I had known Robert for 10 years, but had kind of lost track of him. Came home to visit my mother, and there he was, a Boy Scout executive now. The war was over. He was out of the Air Force and back home. And before I left to go back to Chicago, he proposed. And he said, you go back to Chicago and think about this. And then you decide if you want to come home and marry me. But I have some letters from him that are pretty romantic that he sent me in Chicago, which was a good thing. I don't know if I would have come home if he hadn't sent me those letters, but they were lovely. And so I came home couple of weeks, 6 weeks later, and then in 3 months we were married. And then we moved to a little rental farm south of Farragut, Iowa, and had a baby. And I was very busy on the farm. Now I was going to have my second child. And Robert said to me one day, you need to do something creative. Just to be on a farm and help with the chickens and the hogs and the cattle and separating the milk into cream, you know, all the farm wife things, you're not going to be satisfied. And I want you to be a happy wife.
And already, were you feeling satisfied or were you feeling kind of at a loss because you had given up a great deal to move out to the farm?
It took some adjustment. Sure it did. But I was very much in love. Oh, my. I really was very much in love. And we were both 27 when we married, so we had our first baby the next year. We didn't want to fool around with that scenario. So I was very busy. learning to be a mother, which is a hard thing to do when you have never had that experience. So Robert saw in the newspaper an ad wanting a farm wife to write a weekly newspaper column. And he said to me, "You could do that." And I said, "I've never written. I've talked a lot. I've done workshops. I've taught school. I've taught kids. And I've done all kinds of public things. But I have never written." He said, "It's just putting down words." And I said, "Aha, I can't spell." He said, "I'll buy you a dictionary."
He was really determined that you were going to give this a try.
It's all his fault. And anytime anything comes up about me taking extra time, you know, to write or to speak, I say, "It's all your fault. You got me into this." And I loved it. I loved it. But it was very hard.
How did that first column come about? Because you had never done anything like that before, right?
Oh, no. And he literally, he pulled out the typewriter, he pulled out the card table to put it on and got the paper, and he sat me down and he said, "Put down something, anything." So I just started writing what I had done the week before. The lady I met in the store getting yard goods for the local bazaar, what we were doing on the farm. That's what I wrote about. And then the other thing that Mr. Archie, my publisher, said to me was, "Always put in a recipe." And I panicked. I didn't let him know, but I panicked because I couldn't cook.
And when I read that, I was so surprised, although it makes me feel so good to know that you, of all people, didn't really know how to cook at that time.
No.
So this homemaking thing was pretty new to you. Plus, you were really busy with your children.
Right. And so, the farm, learning. Right. And all the farm women were so capable. I mean, they got their wash out early on Monday morning. It was always white. So I put the clothesline in the back of the house where you couldn't see what time I put my clothes out. They were good gardeners. And I wasn't a good gardener, so I put marigolds all around the garden, and they thought it was so pretty, but it was so they couldn't see the crooked rows. You know, I was tricky. I was sneaky, trying to keep up with these wonderful farm women, and they could cook. Oh, my, but that was my salvation, because when he told me, I threw myself on their mercy. I said to my neighbors and my relatives and my readers. And then the next spring, I started broadcasting with KMA. So now I had listeners. And I said, "I'm not a good cook. I need your help." The best thing I ever, ever did.
I would love it if you would read a little bit of one of your columns for me here. Would you be willing to do that?
Of course.
I would love it if you would read a little bit from the column about your mother and her effort to teach you to cook.
I love that.
It's just wonderful. And I know I have it marked. And here we go. Here, if you could read this for us, that would be wonderful.
"There were many things my mother could not teach me to do. She could not teach me to drive, but then she'd never learned to drive herself. That was a car, driving a car. She couldn't teach me to ride a horse because there were no horses around when I was growing up. But strangest of all, though, was that despite her noble efforts, she hadn't taught me how to cook. Oh, I could put a meal on the table if it meant opening a can from the store or a jar from someone's pantry. But baking, deep fat frying, or putting together a casserole were foreign to my experience. Mother explained years later that she and my father always liked that I enjoyed reading so much. If I had my nose in a book, they did not ask me to do chores around the house or come help in the kitchen. When I moved back to Shenandoah in 1946 to be married, after having several years in Chicago, Mother was close to a panic. 'We need to get you into the kitchen,' she told me. 'I need to teach you to cook, something I should have done a long time ago.' Mother decided she would start with pie crust. I don't know why on earth she decided to do that. Mix up some flour and shortening and add water until it feels right, she instructed. I didn't have a clue what it was supposed to feel like. Then we made the pie filling, and she said, add seasoning until it smells and tastes like it should. Again, I didn't have a clue. Finally, my poor mother threw up her hands in distress. I cook by the pinch and taste and smell method without accurate measurements, and I don't think I can teach you how to cook like I did. You'll have to teach yourself to cook. And she got me a Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, that first one with the red checkerboard cover. I still have that. That's still on my shelf, and it's all tear-stained and worn. The first recipe I tried and why I picked yeast bread, I'll never know. But yeast rolls, and I must have been out of my mind to start with something that complicated, but you know, it really isn't. I learned as I went along that yeast bread is not that complicated if you do it a step at a time. And I did a pretty good job with that first yeast bread roll recipe. A couple of years later, when I began writing my column for the Evening Sentinel, publisher Willard Archie insisted I include a recipe every week. He didn't know I was such a beginning cook, and I didn't tell him. I kept that a secret. I asked my readers, neighbors, and friends for cooking ideas, and the recipes poured in. I always tried out a recipe before printing it, and in later years, our son Craig remembered, if a dish wasn't very successful, I would make it over and serve it to the family again and again until I got it right. If it was good, he laughed. We never saw it again.
That's such a wonderful memory to share. And so you told your listeners, you told your readers that you were learning.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, you know, I told them I was new on the farm and there were so many things I needed help with. And they loved it. They liked helping me. But the listeners also wrote in their problems and their needs. And the Radio Homemakers, we were the Dear Abby of that day. There was no Dear Abby. There weren't support groups. And we're talking back in the 50s, 1950s. And so I think this is one of the reasons the Radio Homemakers grew so close to their listeners. We also shared our lives. It was kind of a one man's family on the radio.
I'm talking with Evelyn Berkby. She is a newspaper columnist. She writes the column Up a Country Lane. She began writing that newspaper column in 1949. She's also been a radio homemaker on KMA Radio, part of the Kitchen Clatter program. We'll talk in just a moment about how you got started in radio. And her latest book, her 10th book,
11th
book. 11th book,
yes,
is Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me now is Evelyn Berkby. You may very well know something about Evelyn Berkby because she has been working in Iowa for many, many years. She began writing the newspaper column Up a Country Lane in 1949. She also became a radio homemaker on KMA Radio and Shenandoah, part of the Kitchen Clatter program. She's written now 11 books. Her latest book is Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. She's been the subject of an Iowa Public Television documentary. She's even been immortalized in fiction. We'll talk about that in a few minutes as well. And Evelyn, we've talked about how you started writing this newspaper column in 1949. Your husband saw the advertisement in the paper and said, you must do this. This is the perfect thing for you, something that you'd really never considered doing before. You started writing the column, a weekly column. How did you get into radio?
KMA had a bevy of radio homemakers. At one time, Shenandoah actually had 14 between KMA and KFNF, the other radio station in Shenandoah. So they were just loaded with women who were on radio. And the head of the women's department in KMA, Doris Murphy, called me up and she said, I've been reading your column, and I think it would translate it very well into a radio program. And we would like to have you become one of our radio homemakers. And, of course, now I had done speaking, so this was a little more easy for me to translate into radio than it had been into writing. But I found it such an interesting, again, an outlet and an outreach. The whole world ended up being in my little mailbox and in that microphone. And that's what happens with radio and with print media both, because you could reach out. And now the computer takes you all over the world. I feel every morning that I reach out with my computer into the whole world.
Radio is so intimate. And the newspaper columns are too. It's something that people do when they're alone. They listen to the radio when they're alone in their kitchen or in their car. They read the newspaper by themselves. So how did you feel about this one-on-one relationship that you were really developing with all of these listeners, men and women?
My father was a minister. My father and mother insisted, as I was growing up, that I do everything that I was asked to do in front of the public. And in school, I was in plays, I was in the declam, I was doing all of the things that put me up in front of people. I would go home and be sick. I was so nervous. It took me into my years of school teaching before I got over that. But what that did was meant that he taught me you only talk to people one at a time. You have a room full of 100 people. You're not talking to 100 people. You're talking to one person. When you're on the radio, like today, I'm not talking to a whole lot of people out there. One at a time. Well, that saved me, because when I sat down that first day to the microphone, I thought of a good friend of mine that lived in Farragut, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to talk to her. And I began to share my life, and that's what I've done for 63 years.
This newest book is a collection of some of your favorite columns, and I was wondering if you'd read a little bit of another one of those columns for us about some advice you got when you first started out on the radio, because I can imagine that giving recipes on the radio would be very difficult, and you have to be very precise and go slowly and make sure people understand what's going on. This one's called Recipe Goofs, and again, you can just read right up to the line.
This is fun, Charity, to see what you've picked out of the columns that you've been reading. In my book, Neighboring on the Air, I tell the story of the time when I first began broadcasting for radio station KMA in 1950. Bernice Currier, a fellow radio homemaker, cautioned me about the problems with recipes. They're booby traps, she warned. No matter how careful you are in giving a recipe or writing it down or having it printed, it can trip you up. Numbers get transposed, quantities suddenly grow or shrink, and ingredients can disappear altogether. Think about the recipe, she cautioned. Be cautious of what they should contain and the way they go together. Never relax. Recipes will clobber you if you do. I took what she said to heart, but I soon learned that no matter how cautious I was, mistakes in quantity or in ingredients in my recipes could still slip in. Always, always, when I did make a mistake, I hoped my error would be bad enough people would recognize it and not try the recipe as given. Through the years, I have made my share of recipe missteps. For example, I well remember the applesauce cake recipe printed in the column didn't have any applesauce in the ingredients. Well, anybody with any sense, which I should have had when I reread my column before I sent it in, which I always do, but I didn't see that. Another time, I simply misprinted a recipe title. just two little letters wrong. But it made a big and hilarious difference. Lady had sent me a handwritten recipe for a dessert. I read the title as Cherry Brownies and printed it as she sent it. The telephone rang soon after. The newspaper hit the street. You didn't have any cherries in the recipe, the caller told me. Soon the woman who sent the recipe called me. You got it wrong, she said. They're chewy brownies, not cherry. I had misread her handwriting, and I didn't catch the fact that no cherries were in the recipe. One of my most memorable errors was a typo in the newspaper at a time when my copy went in via a typed page that was then manually retyped and then set in cold metal type on another machine by the typesetter. Many hands handled my original recipe before the final printed version appeared. I had sent in a recipe for a grapefruit salad that included 1/2 cup of sugar. Somehow, in all the typing and retyping, the slice was left out between the 1 and the 2, and the final print said, 12 cups of sugar in my little grapefruit salad. Thank goodness anyone who cooked at all would know that 12 cups was far too much sugar for a simple gelatin salad, even with tart grapefruit as one of the ingredients.
Evelyn Berkby reading from her most recent book, Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. One of the other mistakes that you talk about in that column is not a mistake you made, but a mistake because of proofreading, because you were writing about morel mushrooms and they changed it to moral mushrooms.
That was one of my favorites, and I giggled about that. I still do, because it's so funny when you think of moral mushrooms. The next week I wrote a column about these moral mushrooms.
Upstanding, upright citizen mushrooms of southwestern Iowa.
Yes, yes. I like things light and fun. So much of life is serious and hard. And I like things we could laugh about and things that are fun.
With doing the radio show and the weekly column, how much time do you think you spent every week back then working on this?
Oh, my. I've never thought about that. I used to get up at 5 a.m. and write. I don't get up that early anymore. But I always think it takes about 2 days to work on a column, and sometimes a little longer. Now my 3 sons are my helpers, and they advise me. Right now, you know what they are suggesting I write more about?
What?
Being old. They say that not very many people over 90 are writing about how it feels.
That's true.
And so in my latest book, I do have a chapter that I call Aging is Opportunity. And I have found so many opportunities in my life. This has been one of the greatest years. And I'll be 93. I was 93, 31st of July. So this is a real landmark in my life, and writing about how it feels and how to make it an adventure. And I talk a lot to young people, and I love that because they ask me questions about what it's like being old.
Back when you were a radio homemaker, you were one of few working mothers. Now that's very common, but that back then it wasn't very common for a woman with children to work outside the home. Did you have a difficult time juggling the responsibilities of work and I'm sure the draw to do even more, get more involved with work, and you were a mother of 4 children?
I balance things, I hope. You know, we always hope we choose well. But I would be home when they went to school. I was always home when they came home. A lot of my work I did at home because all my writing and my preparation for my radio broadcasts were at home. I would do a live broadcast at KMA and then tape the next day. Then I would go back and do a live broadcast and tape. And the week would move right along. And I would do the errands and the grocery shopping and the things that you need to do in town when you go in. So it all worked out very well. And I never felt that I took any special value from one to give the other. And many, many, many more women worked than are given credit for. And we know that during the war was when a lot of them went into manufacturing and heavy work. But there were women, I think of the radio homemakers. Bernice Currier was a divorced mother of four children. Doris Murphy had lost her husband when her little boy was 18 months.
Oh.
There are stories, sad stories, struggling of women who were raising children alone, just as there are today. And the women on the farm probably worked harder than anybody. And I do have a chapter in this new book about the good old days. And when people tell me, you had it easier in the olden days, I say, okay, sit down, let's talk.
Do people really tell you that?
Oh, yes, oh. All the time. Oh, it's much harder
they
now.
They haven't read enough, I guess.
Well, it's a choice. How you spend your time and what you do with your family and what you do with your work, it's all a choice. But back in some of those days, once a person became a farm wife, they didn't have much choice if they were going to keep their family washed and clean and fed and in a clean house and all the other things that they did to keep things going.
Once you started writing this column, clearly you made a very strong commitment to it. I mean, you've been doing it for 63 years, but in the book you say that there are only two columns that you didn't write. There's been a column every week your husband wrote two for you. And so you were having babies and writing a column the same week. Why was it so important to you? I'm sure that your publisher would have given you a week off if you'd asked. Why was it so important to you to do that?
I didn't realize for quite a while that I hadn't missed a week, except for those two that my husband wrote. And then it kind of became a challenge. Could I keep doing it? If I quit maybe and went on vacation for two or three weeks, would they want me back when I came back? Maybe they would find out they could get along without me. So when we went on a vacation, I would take my little portable typewriter along, put it on the picnic table next to the tent, because we did family tent camping. And I would start typing the column that I was going to put in the mail for the coming week. But here would come people. What are you doing? And I would say, well, I'm typing a newspaper column. Oh, what about? And they would sit down, and I couldn't get it written. Well, eventually I did because I wanted to get it in, but I decided that was for the birds. So then I began writing ahead of time. If I'm going to be gone now, I write ahead of time. My sons have written some columns for me. If I needed help for a certain week or if they did something very exciting, then and they have done so many exciting things. I could fill my column with things they're doing even today. So this is why. Does that answer your question?
I think so. But what did it mean to you to have that column? Because obviously it has been an important part of your life. But I keep imagining you back then, with all these kids to take care of and so many responsibilities on the farm, what did it mean to you to have this identity outside of the home?
I had had a pretty interesting career, both in teaching and in the church in Chicago, where I really did have recognition. And you know, recognition is something that you like. It's a good feeling to feel that you're doing something of value and something worthwhile. But I did not ever plan ahead saying, this is what I'm going to do to be important. You know, not that. It was just, this is a challenge and this is exciting, and it's fun, and I'm sharing my family. And when I test recipes, I share that with my family. So much of what I did was family-oriented, and I liked that. And being in a little small town, what do you do to feel that you're doing something of value? But my whole life has been one step at a time. I didn't ever plan to do this. It was all accidental. It was Robert pushing me out the door saying, you can go do it. But then I had to start doing it. And then once I started, I found it was exciting. And you know, everybody's got a story. So once I started writing, here were stories. And not only my stories, but my relatives and my neighbors and other people's stories. So there's a whole wealth. I never run out of things to write about.
I'm talking with Evelyn Berkby. She is the author, most recently, of Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living from Iowa's Best Known Homemaker. It's a collection of some of her favorite columns over the last 63 years of writing the newspaper column Up a Country Lane. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is Evelyn Berkby. Back in 1949, she was living on a farm in southwestern Iowa, and she started writing a weekly newspaper column called Up a Country Lane. She still writes that column. She's been doing that for 63 years. She also became a radio homemaker on KMA Radio, part of the Kitchen Clatter program. She is the author of 11 books now and is known all over the United States. She's been immortalized in fiction, and she's had a documentary made about her and the other homemakers on Iowa Public Television. And Evelyn, before the break, we were talking about the fact that you never missed a column. And one of the things that surprised me in reading your book, you lost your oldest child, your daughter, and you wrote a column the week that she died. How did you find the strength to do that?
It was a blessing. It was a help. I said to Robert, I don't think I can do this. He said, yes, you can. Help. So we did. I have printed it. It was in the paper. It was the obituary. But I've never put it in a book before. And the grief is still there, you can tell.
Yes.
Yeah. You never stop grieving. Nope. But that whole chapter on leaning on the everlasting arms is what I called it in my new book, because there are stories of people that mean so much. And I don't have very many good friends left anymore. I'm getting very emotional, but that's okay. Emotion is good. Emotion is good. When you hit 90, you've lost most of your good friends and family. So what do you do? I reach out to young people. I go to high schools. I've gone to colleges to talk. And I love being with young people. So that's what I emphasize. And then the great value in getting back to where I was when I lost a child, I was young enough to have more, and that was such a blessing. So we had two more, and they're wonderful, wonderful. All three of our boys are so good to us, and we are so fortunate Robert and I are still together. So you look at the blessings. It's good. It's good.
In sharing such personal things in your column, you really did open up your family and open up yourself, make yourself vulnerable. When people who read your work approach you, how does that feel? Because they must feel as if they know you well, although you may be meeting them for the first time.
But we're friends, and I feel that they're friends. People knock on the door sometimes and say, I've listened to you, and I read, and I wanted to stop by and say hello. this happened a lot more in the olden days of radio. But now, even now, people will do that. And I feel like we're instant friends. They know who I am, and basically, I know who they are. Midwestern people are open and friendly, and I love people. I love people. And being a good friend and sharing my life has been a good thing. Probably a great value. I would hope that for everybody, that they can share with other people.
You were extremely well known in your corner of the world in southwestern Iowa, as people listening to you on the radio and people reading your column. But that was kind of your sphere for a very long time. And then you started to get noticed outside of that sphere. And some of the first people to notice you were Jane and Michael Stern, who, of course, public radio listeners know them because they hear them every week on The Splendid Table with Lynn Rossetto Casper. How did you get connected with Jane and Michael Stern?
I'll try to be very brief about this, but when I was working with KMA, I began learning more and more about the Radio Homemakers. And so I thought, you know, there's a story here that has never been told. I need to write the story of the Radio Homemakers. So I contacted the Des Moines Register and said, I would like to write an article for you about the Radio Homemakers in the Midwest. And they wrote back and said, well, it's a good idea. It will be a good story. But no, we don't want you to write it. We'll send one of our staff down. Well, that was not what I had in mind at all. I had been writing a little while, and I was back at KMA. I had left Kitchen Clatter to come back to KMA to start their book department and do books, write books for them. It took me a day. And then I said to myself, you need to get out of the way. If they want to do this story, I'll let them do the story. It's too important for me to be a handicap to this. Let's let them do what they want to do. When they wrote the story, and they had a lovely front page story, they said that I was a resource at KMA. In Ames was a lady named Susan Puckett attending college, and she was writing a book called A Cook's Tour of Iowa. She wanted a chapter on the Radio Homemakers. She read in the Des Moines Register that I was the person to contact, so she contacted me. She was a good friend of Jane and Michael Stern, and she said, I'm going to tell Jane and Michael Stern about you because you're their kind of person and they're your kind of person. That's how I met Jane and Michael Stern. And they came out to Shenandoah, stayed a weekend, ate on my porch. We had a wonderful, wonderful time. And they're still writing about that. They wrote a 17-page article in the,
first article.
New Yorker.
Okay.
The New Yorker magazine. They wrote 12 pages. And now people from all over New York and Los Angeles, and they wanted this story. They wanted to come and televise this place in the Midwest that was such an interesting story that Jane and Michael had.
Were you surprised all of a sudden when all this national media wanted that story?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, the first television station that called, I was surprised. And I said, oh, there's nothing down here for you. And I hung up. And I thought, okay, I've ended it. It's over. I blew it. I'll never hear from another television station. Well, I did. All three of the major television stations either came down to Southwest Iowa or they took me to Washington, D.C. They took me to New York, where I was on their national television. So that was an interesting experience to have. But Fannie Flagg, have you got Fannie Flagg in your radar?
Yes. Now, Fannie Flagg is a well-known author, and I think the first book that she wrote that really got national attention was Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. After that, she discovered you too.
I did write a book about the Radio Homemakers, as you know, and it is called Neighboring on the Air, which is what Radio Homemakers do. And it was in a little bookstore down in Georgia. And Fanny was down there in that little bookstore and found it. Fanny liked the idea of Radio Homemakers. And she called me up and she said, "This is Fanny Flagg." And I said, "I only know one Fanny Flagg in the whole world." She said, "That's me." And then she...
So you had read her books?
Oh, sure, sure. And I'd watched her on television. You know, she's been in many venues. So I did meet her once. She wrote Standing in the Rainbow, which was her major character was neighbor Dorothy, who was a radio homemaker. And it's a lovely book. I love it. I love it.
And are you Dorothy?
Well, some people have said they recognize me. But among the things that Fanny mentions, neighbor Dorothy lived in Missouri. And she came up to Shenandoah, where KMA Radio was, and visited with Evelyn Berkby.
Oh.
She put that in her book.
Wonderful.
So I don't think, but I would like to end talking about Fanny by saying that the latest book that she has with neighbor Dorothy in is Can't Wait to Get to Heaven. And in there, Aunt Eleanor falls off a ladder and goes to heaven. Well, she really doesn't stay very long. But while she was there, she met neighbor Dorothy, and neighbor Dorothy baked her a cake. So when I read that, I said to Robert, "You know, I kind of like the idea. When I get to heaven, I'm going to see if there's a kitchen someplace so I can go bake a cake."
How has all of this attention changed the way that you think about what you've done?
I'm amazed. I'm absolutely amazed. And being 93 now and having all of the accolades from this new book and knowing how people are relating to it and enjoying it gives me such pleasure. And people tell me that I make them feel better, that I have a positive view of life, even as I'm getting elderly. And I like that. Every age has its opportunities, and I want people to know that. And I tell young people, keep your mind sharp. You have one brain. You don't ever get a second chance. Keep it clean. And then if you live to be 90, you'll be very happy that you kept your mind sharp. And drink lots of milk. And be positive. I think a positive attitude and a loving approach to life and neighbors and family make you live longer. If not, it's certainly happier.
You always knew you were connecting with people, though. Some of the stories that you share in your book about people recording your recipes. I love those stories. One woman told you that her mother wrote down every single recipe and kept every single recipe that you ever gave out on the air in her recipe box. And then she went on to say, but she never made any of them.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. But there was a connection there. She wrote it down because she was connecting with me. And it meant something to her. So it meant something to me to know that we had that connection. And it was okay. I mean, I give too many recipes for people to do all of them. And that's okay.
I also love the story you shared about the man writing the recipe down in the dust on the hood of his tractor.
Yes. I don't remember if I knew what the recipe was, but he let me know, or his wife probably is the one that let me know, that I was giving this on his tractor radio, and he always listened. And I like it that men are out there listening. Anyway, he thought this recipe was going to sound good, so he stopped the tractor and got off and wrote it in the dust because he didn't have pencil and paper. And then he quickly went back up to the house, and he ran in, and he said to his wife, "Quick, take pencil and paper out and write that down before the wind blows it off."
You may be the only person in the world to have given a recipe that was recorded in that way, Evelyn.
Well, I love that story. It has several layers. It's like my friend who had this cake. She made the best cake in the whole world, and she would not give me the recipe because she said, and listen to this, if I give you my recipe, you'll put it in the paper, then everybody will make that same cake, and I won't have anything I do that's special. That shocked me. This woman was a farm wife, a widow who ran the farm, who raised her children, who did things in the community, in the church, and yet the only thing she thought made her special was a cake. Now, that says something about the attitude toward women back in some of the early days.
Now that you are in your 90s, how is your health? You look wonderful here in front of me, but how are you doing?
I am amazed at how well I'm doing. I'm using a cane now. I'm trying to look elegant. I'm trying to say to myself, it's okay if you have a need for some help, accept it. It goes with the territory. At least I can get around. And my mind's still clear, and I can still get on the typewriter or the computer. And I love it because I'm close to friends, I'm close to my family, and it's so easy because it has a spell checker. I don't need those dictionaries anymore.
How is Robert's health, your husband?
He is a little frailer, but he goes out and mows. And he does work that I think's too heavy sometimes. He went out and picked sweet corn the other day in a farmer's field back when it was ready. That was toward the end of July. And I scolded him for going out. It was hot that day. But he likes to keep on doing things, and we help each other. And we fixed our house up for our old age, whenever that comes.
Do you have a 12th book that's simmering in your mind?
My two sons heard me say, okay, I've got this book. The University of Iowa Press is publishing it. I'm so happy about that. And they are so fun to work with. They're lovely. And they have done two of my other books, The Up a Country Lane and The Neighboring on the Air, they published. I also have Witching for William, which my Honey Hill Books, which is my publishing company that published. So I said, you know, this is probably it. I'll just kind of sit back on my laurels, whatever those are. And my boy said, oh, no, you've got some more things you need to write. So they have suggested a couple more books for me. And you know what? I've started. I've now got my little folders on my computer that have the names of these two books. And I think maybe I've spent 2 days, 3 days maybe working on them. But at least I'm started. And I have all those columns. You suppose maybe I could do another column book? I don't know.
Number 14.
I don't know. But I do one. Next to my computer is a poster. And my boy's got this. It has a rocking chair. And underneath it says, keep off. So they keep encouraging me. Keep off the rocking chair. Keep writing. People want you to, and you need to.
Evelyn Berkby, thank you so much.
This has been delightful for me. Thank you for having me.
Well, and thank you for everything, and thank you for paving the way for so many of us who have followed in your footsteps.
Thank you.
Evelyn Berkby, her latest book is called Always Put in a Recipe and Other Tips for Living. You can find out more at evelynberkby.com. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.